previously on Beta.
Customer service isn't our strongest point at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Do you think men are important? Like for what?
Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back for the opening kickoff in just one moment.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, author Steve Almond unveils his grand vision for a football league that operates according to the philosophy of Karl Marx.
And the worker who washes his jockstrap, or the custodian who mops the floors of the locker room, might be paid just as much as Aaron Rodgers.
Also, Sandra Newman joins us to talk about her latest novel, The Men. It's a haunting and surreal story in which all of the people with a Y chromosome have suddenly disappeared.
That's sort of what we've grown up with, is the idea that men are the source of violence, that men are the source of war, that men are the source of the patriarchy and thus essentially of all injustice.
But first, Frankie Quinones.
Nobody here appreciates how funny I am. These fools have no sense of humor. You know, I bet some of them don't even think a fart is funny.
Why do you feel the need to be funny all the time?
I mean, I don't know. I've always been funny since I was a kid. You know, I have the gift of humor. You know, my father was funny, so am I. You know, it's DNA.
So your father encouraged your sense of humor?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And we watch Cantinflas, Anchorman, Friday. But most importantly, we watch Austin Powers.
It's nice to have that connection with your father.
Yeah, yeah, well, I did, you know, before he passed away. But now I like to think that fool's up in heaven, shagging. Yeah, baby.
Frankie is a comedian currently starring in the Hulu comedy series, This Fool. It's a very funny and very realistic portrayal of working-class Latinos living in South Central Los Angeles. The show's creator, Chris Estrada, plays Julio, and Frankie plays his ex-con cousin, Luis. There's an odd couple dynamic between Julio and Luis, which generates much of the show's comedy. This raises the question, can an ex-con live in his cousin's home without the two of them driving each other crazy? If you spend a lot of time on YouTube, you may already be familiar with Frankie's colorful characters, such as Juanita Carmelita and the creator of Cholo Fit, Creeper. These videos have millions of views. Frankie is also a veteran stand-up comedian and podcast host. He says that comedy and a desire to make people laugh have been a part of his DNA since childhood.
You know, I found a sprinkler head in my dad's truck and I just pretended it was a microphone. I started performing for my family in the living room. But you know, my mom and dad like religiously watched stand-up and comedy, and they always had stand-up on in the house even when I was a kid. You know, they would just tell me to cover my ears and the bad parts. You know, they had everything on: George Carlin, Richard Pryor, Paul Rodriguez, Eddie Murphy, you know, Louis Anderson. I just remember watching all those people growing up, and it was just inspiring for me to see how it helped my mom and dad through tough times and how powerful humor was. And I just started, performing for them in the living room, and I just kind of never stopped. You know, I got in a lot of trouble messing around in the classroom, but I was just always trying to do something to make people laugh.
Yeah. Yeah. And you mentioned you used a sprinkler head as a microphone. And I've read that beyond that, you also dressed in your mom's clothes. Is that true?
Yeah. I was like, yeah, whatever I could find. My dad's clothes, my mom's clothes. Like, you know, I got some of my sister's stuff. Like anything I could find around the house I would just get into some kind of character. And, you know, and just try to put on a show. You know, my mom and dad would roll their eyes every now and then because they would have to turn off the TV and just kind of let me do my thing. But I was grateful that they let me do it and they were supportive.
I'm here knocking the door, man. True story. This is real love. I opened the door. My mom made me a bug catching net out of a wire hanger and an old pair of medias, her pantyhose. Yeah, I was out there. I was like, hey, hell yeah. I was out there with no shame in front of the white people. Like, yeah, you know? The little kid's like, what is that? I'm like, it's my mom's media. What's a media? I don't know, it's my mom's media. We're charging my bug catching territory. Shit, you know? Except my bugs were dying on impact. It was an old pair of pantyhose, you know what I mean? Just bzzz.
You've created many great sketch comedy characters, including one named Juanita Carmelita, alias JC. Can you tell me about her?
Well, yeah, JC, you know what time it is. But yeah, she's just, you know, spicy, diva, call her like a diva on a budget. You know, she kind of gets all her stuff. She gets all her stuff at Ross, and you know, but she makes it look so good. And in her eyes, but yeah, it's pretty much based off my mom. My mom's a very spicy, intense woman, but really positive, you know, filled with love, but also you don't want to get on her bad side kind of thing. And, you know, Juanita Carmelita, JC, is an extension of that. A lot of her stuff is kind of with her boyfriend, Peter, who's played by a friend of mine, Donnie Devanian. And it's kind of funny seeing their interactions.
Peter, you ready to go or what?
Bye, Carmelita.
Excuse me, where are you going?
Me and Frank are gonna go see Black Panther.
Oh, no, you're not. You didn't put it in the Google's calendar.
Whoa, what's the problem?
If it's not in the Google calendar, it's not a real plan. My bad, Frank.
I'll tell you what is in the Google's calendar. It's you and me. You helping me pick out nail polish on Amazon, cabrón. Okay, I got a coupon. We have to use it today by midnight. Plus, you need to save your energy for the Brown Panther.
What does your mom think of your impression of her?
Yeah, she's cool with it. You know, every now and then she'll talk some smack to me like I'm not like that. And I'm like, well, mom, this isn't straight up you. This is just, you know, this is a character, but you obviously influenced it. But, you know, sometimes she'll take it to heart and I kind of got to pull back a little.
But not too often. Most of the time she's on board with it, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, I just kind of do my thing. I'm not making her look bad, I don't think, you know.
No, I don't think so either. But I don't know your mom. But, yeah, I get the impression. Yeah, it's a tribute to her, I think.
Right.
Yeah. Another one of your most famous characters is Creeper. And Creeper promotes an exercise routine called CholoFit. You got to tell us the story behind this.
Oh, yeah, man. So, yeah, Creeper is an extension of my father. My father was old school. He just always represented that style, that culture, but like always had Dickies, his Dickies crease, his white tee tucked in. And then, always drove a low rider, but always there for me, always driving me to Little League practice, and one of the most positive people that I know. And so Creeper kind of, you know, he's like a rehabilitated, you know, cholo, and he's in the thing. And we did a video called Cholo Whisper, actually, where he's rescued from the CRS, the Cholo Rescue Services, by a nice family, and they're having trouble with him, so they call him the Cholo Whisperer. And that video did okay. It got about 500,000 views, and people were like, oh, you got to make a part two. And I was like, well, what's the next step here? I was like, well, he's got to try to get a job. He's going to have trouble getting a job. And in Cholo Whisper, he was kind of doing some yard workouts in the backyard already. So I was like, oh, I know. He could teach a workout class in the backyard.
All right, and this one is a resistance workout. I'll need a volunteer. Hey, OG. Come up here, homie. Right here, we're gonna do a resistance workout where if I have Plato with somebody, like, hey, fool, like, you've been talking papas about my lady. I don't really like that right now. So right now, I'm putting my chest up on you, like I'm about to throw down, and then you get the resistance right there, you see? You already feel it. You feel it down here in your gluteus muscle minus or whatever, and down to the calves. No disrespect, OG, this is just a workout. You know I got mad respect, homie. All right, you do that for about maybe a minute, because longer than that, then you really start to fight, and it's a trick.
You know, we put that up, and it just spread like wildfire. It was really like that. Like, we posted it. We're like, I knew it was funny, but I didn't know it was going to be that big. The next day I woke up and it was just like all these millions of views, and I'm getting messages from Australia and Thailand and all these crazy places. And it was crazy.
Yeah. That's great though. Your father, I guess, is probably okay with your impression of him, much like your mom is okay with your impression of her.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, my dad's super supportive. He's in the Cholo Fit video, and we do the Cholo Metrics, the resistant workout. Mm,
right.
Yeah, I'm like, hey, OG, that's my dad. That's my real father. Yeah.
Oh, I see. That's great. Good. Thank you for telling me that. How did you go about developing the Creeper character?
You know, after that first video went viral, I started, you know, because the first video I did as Creeper was 10 years, you know, so I had been working on him, trying to polish him up, finding his voice. And then when the Cholo Fit thing went viral, I really was like, oh man, people are drawn to his physicality and stuff like that. So I started watching a lot of old Buster Keaton videos, Three Stooges, Benny Hill, all those legendary old school, physical comedians. Even Mr. Bean, he has a lot of silent videos that are hilarious. And so I try to watch that, you know, and try to draw from that, because there was a couple of other videos where I'm not saying anything. I'm kind of just like in a situation where I'm getting kicked out of a bar or something, and I'm just like walking around the guy and doing all these moves, these physical moves, and people loved it. And it was just like, you know, and the physical comedy is universal. And so there was a bunch of people around the world just drawn to it. And so I was inspired by that, you know, and I was like, oh man. So I really got into it. Even though I'm getting older, you know, I can only do so many cholo squats. I try to commit to the physicality and the physical comedy side of it.
Yeah, and that must be really gratifying to be able to make people laugh without speaking.
Right. Yeah. It's cool, man. I like it.
Yeah, I can imagine you would. Yeah. Your latest project is this very funny comedy series called This Fool, which is now streaming on Hulu. And you play a guy named Luis. How different is Luis from Frankie?
I mean, there's definitely a big part of Frankie in there, but I would say, I mean, there's definitely a lot of differences, though. Like, you know, I've never been to prison or anything like that. I've had, you know, when I was younger, I kind of got in some trouble, but that's, yeah, we'll pass that. But I was able to draw from, you know, I've had cousins, you know, fortunately, a lot of them got their act together and they're all about their family now. But they were, you know, in and out of prison as we were growing up. And so I kind of drew from them and, you know, some cousins that are really funny and they're always in and out of jail. But you're like, oh, man, he went back to jail. You're just making me laugh yesterday at the barbecue. You know, it's like, so it's kind of like, I was kind of able to draw from that. Like Luis is a nice guy and he's funny, which is straight up. Me, Frankie, you know, there's a lot of my homies that comment, they're like, oh man, you're just playing yourself. And I'm like, yeah, but I had to draw from this this side where Luis could be kind of a little bit intimidating sometimes, or just maybe like a loose cannon, like, oh, what is he going to do? Kind of like a Joe Pesci kind of vibe to him.
Yeah, yeah.
But in cholo form, like, yeah, he's funny and likable, but watch out, you know, he might do something crazy.
Right,
so
yeah.
I would say that funny, likable side is more of Frankie, and then that little dangerous side to him is more from my family and my relatives that have those experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that Joe Pesci comparison. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I like that. The series was created by Chris Estrada, and he plays your cousin Julio. Can you talk about the dynamic between Julio and your character, Luis?
It's a lot of fun. Like, he's, you know, he acts like he's got his stuff more together than I do, but actually he's still living at his mom's house, and I'm living there too, my aunt. Mm-hmm. And he tries to talk to me like, you know, he's the one that has his stuff together when really he's not. So, you know, and then Luis is very emotionally immature. So he's constantly poking fun at Julio. And so it's kind of funny because, you know, Julio's like, he can help. He likes to help everybody else, but he obviously can't help himself. And he keeps like keeping himself as the underdog and always getting kind of beat up emotionally by his on and off girlfriend. And then he has his cousin, me, just kind of always tearing him down, keeping him in his place. And so it's funny, man. It's like it's a cool version of an odd couple that I see, because it's funny, because in real life, our relationship is like that. Like, Chris and I toured for almost 4 years together, where he would be opening for me. And then we were always together, and he's like very like, you know, like, I'm all like, hey, what's up, guys? Positive vibes. And he goes, oh man, people, we got to deal with them today. Or like, you know, so and that, I think that a lot of that chemistry translates to on camera.
You know what they say? Laughter's the best Tylenol.
Don't you mean best medicine?
Is Tylenol medicine?
Yeah.
Well, then I think I got it right.
A bunch of our co-stars always comment on that. They're like, man, they're almost the same off camera because we're constantly talking smack to each other. But yeah.
One critic has described Luis as equal parts obnoxious and charming. What do you think of that description?
I totally agree. It's a man, he just comes off as so clueless sometimes, you know, but you're like, ah, man, you're still, you know, rooting for him in some way. Like, I'm never watching Luis, I'm like, oh man, like he's kind of like a likable dumb, you know. You're not like you're not like annoyed by how obnoxious he is or how clueless he is. You're just kind of like, oh man, you know, he's figuring it out, it's all right. But but yeah, I think that's a great wording on how to describe his character. Like, obnoxious and charming. Yeah. I haven't heard that yet, but that's right on the money.
Yeah. One of the things that makes This Fool so different from other comedy series is the way in which it features working class people in Los Angeles. How important is that to the success of the show?
Oh man, it was very important, because a lot of times it's, you know, it's hard to nail the authenticity on a show, especially when, you know, you were doing things like representing the working class and stuff like that, and our, you know, the ways that we grew up and the connections we have with people. But I think we, you know, Chris and the rest of the crew and all of us, even the you know, some of the producers that didn't have the same experiences that we do, they were constantly checking in on the smallest details to make sure that this show felt authentic. And, you know, Chris, down to the wardrobe, even Chris's sister was did the wardrobe on the show. And so everything was like to a T. And I think that really helps, you know, in the big picture of what we were trying to express in the show. And I think that's why people are so connected to it. Even if you're from a different background, whatever, when something is that authentic, you're still drawn to it. Like, oh man, these are real people. And so once you get them in there, then you could, the funny stuff just comes up pretty organically. It was fun to be part of that. They were constantly checking in about the details and the authenticity of the show. So, and now even walking around LA, there's so many people that are just day-to-day people. They're just, hey man, love the show. Da, da, da. I feel like I grew up with you and stuff like that. And I'm like, oh man, when people say stuff like that, you're like, oh, we did it. We nailed it.
Absolutely, yeah. Mission accomplished, most definitely. What do you think the show is doing differently in terms of the way it presents Latino characters?
To me, what stands out is all the messages that are in the show are kind of sitting there organically. You know, they're not like there's no like message or crazy messages we're trying to shove down your throat, you know, like in a theme of an episode or whatever. Like there's messages in there, but they're kind of just sitting in there where you see them, and they're kind of easier to take in. Because for the most part, we just wanted to make something funny, you know, like just give people a chance at something easy to watch, just take it in. And we just want you to laugh. You know, we weren't trying to be like, hey, like we're the voice of all Latinos. You know what I mean? We definitely weren't trying to do that. We were just like sharing our story, sharing Chris's story and being real and authentic and just being funny. Like that was the main goal. Just make it funny, man. And so when we did that, and, you know, there are messages in there, but yeah, they're just kind of easy to digest. The way we presented them.
Absolutely. You're not beating the viewers' heads over with the message. They're quite subtle, but they're
right,
there.
Exactly.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Michael Imperioli, best known as Christopher Moltisanti from The Sopranos, plays Minister Payne on the show, and he's the founder of the Hugs Not Thugs Rehabilitation Center for people like Luis who have been released from prison. What is it like working with him?
Oh, man, it was an honor. I actually was pretty nervous the first day, my first scene with him, because it was just him and I. You know, the producers try to play a joke on me. They kind of scared me. They go, hey, man, he doesn't, unless the camera's rolling, he doesn't like to be looked in the eye. And, and I was like, they were like playing it serious. So I was like, oh, okay. Like, I didn't know. Maybe that's how, you know, I didn't want to take him off his game or his zone or whatever, whatever it takes to get him ready for a scene. So I'm walking up to him. He comes up to me. He's being cool. You know, he's like, hey, man, you want to run some lines and da, da, da. And I'm like looking all around, not trying to make eye contact. I'm like, yeah, sure, bro. Like, I'll run some lines. Like, and he was the guy looking at me like, what's wrong with this guy? You know? And I'm like, oh, man, I'm sorry. They told me not to make eye contact with you. He's like, oh, no, that's true. And then but then he slaps me on the back. He's like, nah, man, I'm just kidding.
Hey, Luis. You're not thinking about going to talk to your ex alone, are you? Because in situations like these, emotions can run really high and get in the way of constructive dialogue. I can help you get the ring back. Once upon a time, I used to manage a strip club, so this will be a cakewalk compared to that.
Damn, what kind of doctor manages a strip club?
Luis, I have square danced in towns you've never even heard of. Also, I'm not a doctor, I'm a minister.
Even after that first scene, he made me feel so comfortable and like kind of, you know, we come from comedy backgrounds and this guy's like an Emmy award winning actor, you know? So it's like humbling and just dope and so cool that he was willing to he was giving me notes and, you know, complimenting me. He just really made me so confident and helped me, you know, dial in, made me feel that I had Luis so dialed in and helped me get into a groove. Like the scenes we have together, we were just bouncing back and forth off each other. Even when I would like flub my lines, he would pick me up right away and just boom. Like, all right, let's keep it going. Bap, bap. And we just developed this chemistry. And I owe a lot to that guy. I learned so much from him, and he definitely made me a better actor. So thank you, Michael. Love you, brother.
And he'll hear that because I'm sure he listens to the show. Yeah. So that's great. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Frankie Quinones, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on This Fool, your stand-up, and all the rest of your comedy.
Oh, thank you, sir. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Frankie Quinones is a comedian and actor. He stars in the Hulu comedy series This Fool. You can find out more about Frankie at WPR.org/beta.
And then she finds that when she gets through to 911, she's told that she can't get help if her emergency is regarding a male.
Coming up, what would it be like to live in a world without men? Sandra Newman gives us a pretty accurate idea in her latest novel, The Men. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. It starts in the mountains of Northern California in late August. Jane Pearson is camping with her husband and their 5-year-old son. As Jane relaxes in a hammock, it happens. Her husband and son disappear, and they're not the only ones. Every person with a Y chromosome in the whole wide world also vanishes. After the disappearance of the men, Jane finds herself in a new world in which women rebuild society. That's the premise behind Sandra Newman's mind-bending, propulsive novel, The Men. She joined us to talk about The Men and what inspired her to write it.
This book was partly inspired by my reading of other such books, which often is where books come from, particularly the book The Female Man by Joanna Russ, which is sort of a landmark work of feminist science fiction, which has a female utopia where all of the men have disappeared and women form this completely different society over hundreds of years. And also, I think a lot of it is about the kind of political angst that most people have been going through, where you look at the state of the world and all of the potential solutions to the state of the world that seem to be failing catastrophically all around you, and try to understand why the solutions fail and why people are so desperate and incapable of coming up with better solutions that can stick.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to just drill down a bit more about the inspiration of how Joanna Russ's novel, The Female Man, how that influenced The Men. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Well, I think her book is one of the few books of this kind. There are a bunch of books where all the men disappear, generally the men die in a plague, but the plague is in the distant past. Or sometimes the men are just separated from the women, and that's how it has been for hundreds of years. And this allows the women to form a society which is assumed to be better because women are better than men. It's sort of a feminist cliche of second wave feminism, the 70s and 80s, were when most of these books were written, and there were a great many of them. And so in my book, it's more that the disaster happens now, which I think this is a more typical, like in the last few years, or really since Why the Last Man, which was 2002, there have been a number of books that dealt with the same idea, but as a catastrophe that is happening now. The men are dying now, the men have died now, and the women have to somehow save the men, usually. They're trying to save the men so that we can save the human race. And it's generally more of an action story than it is a political story. And I was trying, I guess, to deal with the side of the story which is predicated on a fantasy of genocide, and to deal with the moral implications of that in a more head-on way than Joanna Russ really does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I have to say, as a man, it was very refreshing to read a novel without any male characters. I thought it was a really nice change, I have to say. The Men opens with Jane Pearson, her husband Leo, and their 5-year-old son Benjamin camping in the California woods. What happens?
Well, she wakes up and her husband and son are gone. And at first she comes up with rational explanations for this. They must have gone for a hike without waking me up. And that doesn't make sense because it's not something that they would do, but it's the only thing that could make sense. And so she begins to make coffee, but they don't come back. And then, of course, she begins looking for them and calling for them. She becomes increasingly upset. She can't get a phone signal, so she goes down the mountain until she can get a phone signal. And then she finds that when she gets through to 911, she's told that she can't get help if her emergency is regarding a male.
and this doesn't make sense, so she calls again. And it goes on for a while before she begins to actually grasp that there is no help for this. And then she does the thing I think most people would do, which is to continue searching for them nonetheless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And can you talk a bit about how this event, the disappearance, how this affects the women who do not disappear, who remain on Earth?
What it is, it's a mass grief. It's basically the entire world turns into the kind of atmosphere that you get in, I guess, a big family when there's been a bereavement and everybody is desperately upset, but everyone is also sort of bonding around feeling the same thing, around the distress that they have and the struggle to put things back together and continue to live. So it's a strange sort of mix of a new feeling of community with a feeling of mass loss and desperation and confusion.
Mm-hmm. And we should point out also that it all happens. All the men disappear at the same time. And it's just not men, it's children like Jane's son, Benjamin, and it's fetuses. And it's really just it really happens on a global scale, doesn't it?
Yeah. And it's just everyone with a Y chromosome. So there's no explanation whatsoever. There's no sign of what could have happened.
Mm-hmm. One of the intriguing themes that you explore is the possibility that the world might be better off without men. How did you weave that thread into the men?
Again, I did find that that's the default assumption that people have, that at least in our generation and the few generations that are adults now, that's sort of what we've grown up with, is the idea that men are the source of violence, that men are the source of war, that men are the source of the patriarchy and thus essentially of all injustice. And I think that there's some kind of nibbling away at that idea now, but it hasn't really taken hold in the public consciousness. So there is a strong feeling that women are better than men. And I think that when I was writing the book, I actually decided consciously when I began it, because there have been, there's Naomi Alderman's The Power, which is a book where women become more powerful than men. I won't go into the whole premise, but in her book, the assumption is that if women got power, they would become exactly the same as men, in every respect, that it's power that does that and not gender. And I thought that was plausible as an account, but it might be more interesting to suppose that the world would be different. So, and partly I thought that if it's all happening now, if it's just tomorrow there are no people with a Y chromosome, actually people without a Y chromosome have been socialized so differently that it would inevitably be a different society. That kind of social conditioning just wouldn't disappear that quickly.
Yeah, yeah, definitely not. Yeah. Do you think of The Men as a utopian novel or a dystopian novel?
I think it's a bit of both. And I think that all utopias, even the utopias that are intended to be really good utopias that are meant to convince you that this is the way the world should be, end up coming across as a little creepy and terrifying. Thomas More's Utopia is actually, if you read it, creepy and terrifying. Plato's Republic, if you actually think about how it would be to live in that society, it's actually creepy and terrifying. So I think this isn't a world that like those worlds begins to feel fascist, but it is a world where you begin to feel a certain unease as it goes on, and you become increasingly aware that there is this weight of all of the people who are sacrificed in order to bring about this world, and they haven't disappeared. They haunt the world. They're still, in a sense, there. They're part of the world that's been created.
Mm-hmm. At some point after the disappearance, the women start to see signs of men online on a reality show called The Men, and there's this blurry video of men and various strange creatures. Can you tell us a bit about this without revealing any spoilers?
That is the main means by which the men haunt the world. So it's a website where this footage is being streamed 24/7, which seems to show the men, the boys, the trans women, the infants, where they've gone. And we see them marching through this strange landscape. Most people assume this must be a hoax and find it tasteless. in the extreme, and you know they're waiting for the other shoe to drop when they will begin to charge you to watch this footage. But some people believe in it, and they begin to watch it obsessively, hoping to see the people they themselves have lost.
Hmm. Yeah, those points which like recur throughout your novel, that it becomes kind of a horror novel, and it's kind of very unsettling, which obviously is what you intended and what you achieved. There's also this burning girls conspiracy theory. Can you tell us about that?
There's a conspiracy theory which says that at the exact moment of the disappearance around the world, a statistically improbable number of women set themselves on fire. And this is much murkier. It's unclear whether that's really true, you know, whether all of the women involved did set themselves on fire, and it's unclear how that could be connected to the disappearance. So there's a certain sort of sub-theme of conspiracy theories and how the internet is woven into our everyday lives there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Jane Pearson reunites with an old college girlfriend named Evangeline Monroe. Can you tell us a bit about Evangeline?
Evangeline is basically the hero of the story in a way. She's the leader of a far-left organization called the Commensalist Party of the U.S., and both Jane and Evangeline have really complex backstories. And in Evangeline's case, what we first learn about her is that when she was 16, she shot two police officers and went to prison for this. And from this experience, she was radicalized and she's turned into this figure and wrote a book called On Commensalism, which is sort of expounding a new political doctrine.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a bit about On Commensalism, the book, what the political doctrine is that the party believes in?
It's a form of extreme communitarianism, where commensalism is a concept in biology which describes a relationship between two organisms where one organism somehow uses the other organism but without causing it any harm. In Evangeline's political philosophy, commensalism describes a lot of relationships between people. So for her, progressive taxation is an example of one organism, that is the people who have no money, gaining benefit from other organisms, rich people, who are not harmed by it because in no sense do they actually need the money that is taken from them. You can't like regard them as organisms and think this organism needs an extra $1 billion in order to prosper as a creature. So it's sort of reducing these things to a kind of a, I don't know, a biological comparison.
There has been some controversy about the men. Can you tell us about that?
So the objection to not just the men, but to the general trope of men all disappearing, men all dying, generally comes from the transgender community. And it's basically about defining gender according to biological sex. The heart of it is that in all such books, what happens is that people with a Y chromosome or people who are in some sense biologically male are the ones who die or disappear. And that means that you are kind of classing trans women with men and classing trans men with women. And often, like, what generally happens is that the existence of trans people is completely ignored, especially in books written in the 70s and 80s. But in some cases, including in The Female Man, there are just two pages which are about trans women, and they're really transphobic. They're just really gross. So I think that, like, that kind of treatment, either of erasure or of, like, open bigotry has affected the response to this trope, and I think like some of the more recent books have tried very hard not to be transphobic with varying success. Of course, like I really, really tried to treat trans people like with generosity, I guess. But it's hard, actually, to address that particular problem.
Yeah, I thought you did a fine job of the portraying transgender characters. And so I'm curious about what you make of this criticism.
I think the criticism, it's like other criticisms of the kind, like the criticism of the, you know, the genre of the serial killer who commits sex crimes against women. It's sort of the prevalence of it and the way it plays out in each narrative that I think you can actually make a valid criticism of the trope as a trope without saying that every instance of the trope is a crime. which is where I would fall. I would say, yes, we have to, you know, it's worth talking about. It's worth talking about what this says about our assumptions and about the way society looks at gender.
What was the biggest challenge you faced while writing The Men?
Definitely making the plot work. This kind of bizarre and inexplicable thing happens, and the reader reasonably expects that the author will explain it. And so I suffered a lot with coming up with an explanation that would not feel, you know, that would feel bizarre in the right way rather than in the wrong way.
How has writing The Men changed the way you think about women and men? Or has it?
Interesting question. I think there is something interesting about writing a great deal about women's relationships in the absence of men and how women interact with each other and what the norms are for that and what the possibilities are for that without men. Like, one thing that I have noticed is that some things are gendered and that really shouldn't be, like whistling. If you're walking around and you hear someone whistling, I think in the past, the entire time that I've been writing this book and have written it and published it, I have never found that the person whistling in public was a woman. So I think that's one thing that I really noticed, is that women are sort of socialized or taught somehow not to draw attention to themselves in public by making a noise. And that, I think, that really kind of stuck with me and made me think about what it's like to be in a female body in public and how drawing attention to yourself is a bad thing. It's sort of like giving an opening to some kind of attack, potentially.
Yeah, exactly. Sandra Newman, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on The Men.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much. Thanks.
Sandra Newman is the author of The Men. You can find out more about Sandra and The Men at wpr.org/beta.
We are the reason that there are $15 billion in profit each year. And we are contributing to a system where all of that money is absolutely residing at the top.
Coming up, writer Steve Almond joins us to discuss his very intriguing thought experiment. It's all about the MFL, the Marxist Football League. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Playoffs? Don't talk about playoffs. You kidding me? Playoffs?
Next.
Mike, why are you in such a bad mood?
What do you care?
But they are who we thought they were, and we let them off the hook.
What the hell's going on out here?
Who do you think will win the Super Bowl this season? Could it be our hometown heroes, the Green Bay Lumpin' Bourgeoisie? Or maybe the Kansas City commodity fetishism? How about the Pittsburgh Proletariats? If writer Steve Almond's proposal for the Marxist Football League becomes a reality, this is a definite possibility. Steve is the author of many books, including Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. One of the highlights of the book is a thought experiment that really resonated with me. Steve joins Beta now to walk us through it.
Well, this comes through the writer Chuck Klosterman, who writes a lot about sports, and I love his writing. He's brilliant. But he has this quote in one of his books. He says, the reason the NFL is so dominant is because the NFL is basically Marxist. And what he's getting at is the idea that the NFL owners agreed to divide up their TV proceeds equally early in the league's history in order to be able to support the whole league. And Klosterman was sort of exaggerating for effect. That is not Marxism. But when I read that, I thought, what would it be like if the NFL, which is to me kind of capitalism on steroids, what if it was truly Marxist? Well, first, there'd be no private ownership, right? Therefore, there would be no team owners. All those wealthy dudes who are trading football teams like they're, you know, poker chips, at the great gilded casino of billionaires, they would not exist. The teams would be owned by the cities that they lived in, right?
Right.
And they would be represented, right, by these different cities, and those would belong to the state, meaning the government.
The importance of the Green Bay Packers to this city and to the, and I'll say the state of Wisconsin, is huge. You have to understand that the owners are the people. They own the team. You know, we don't have an owner. We have the fans. They're the owners.
Employees would therefore be paid according to this Marxist edict, which we all know, from each according to his ability, to each according to his or her need. And so you would have a top quarterback like Aaron Rodgers, and he would not be paid $50 million a year. He would be paid based on his needs. Let's say he had a couple of kids. Well, he'd make $100,000 a year. That's fair. And the worker who washes his jockstrap, or the custodian who mops the floors of the locker room, might be paid just as much as Aaron Rodgers, maybe even more if he has greater needs. That is quite remarkable to think about. And star athletes ostensibly could still earn large sums of money from endorsement deals from the private industry, but the league would have to decide, if it was Marxist, would have to decide whether these payments violated its Marxist ethics, its tenets. You would not have Commissioner Goodell earning 60 some odd million dollars a year. That just would not exist.
With that, Mr. Goodell, you are now recognized for your testimony.
I am Roger Goodell, Commissioner of the National Football League, and I'm here today to discuss the NFL's efforts to promote safe and respectful workplaces.
And one of the things that could happen is, what would you do, Doug, with the staggering profits?
Yeah.
The NFL earns north of $10 billion a year. Just imagine if that money were no longer being divvied up by this cabal of geriatric magnates or funneled to these star athletes. Right, we can safely assume that the operating costs for the Green Bay Packers, for instance, would be a fraction of the nearly $15 billion that the NFL is going to generate in profits this season.
The major issue during the lockout was splitting up more than $9 billion in league revenues. The old agreement saw nearly a 50-50 split. The new deal gives the owners 53% and the players 47%.
So you would then have a balance of, let's say it's $13 billion that would be available for redistribution to societal needs, such as what? Early education, medical and renewable energy research, intervention for at-risk populations, free therapy for everybody who needs it, mental health counseling. Fans would be in this strange position of justifying their support of pro football by saying, look, it's socially conscious to be a football fan, right?
Yeah.
To me, that's the truly mind-blowing thing, is we, with our money and our attention as fans, feed into this. We are the reason that there are $15 billion in profit each year. And we are contributing to a system where all of that money is absolutely residing at the top. These owners have found a way, in fact, to force public officials in various cities to actually pay for their stadiums to be built, even though they're going to profit from those stadiums.
Yeah, Steve, this is where they build that proposed billion-dollar stadium, right here on this lot, right near UNLV's Thomas and Mack Center. Public money would cover about $750 million of that. Tonight, we're asking, is that fair?
And to me, those kind of obscene economic incentives we've really become used to, but thinking about a world in which you remove them, it would be quite astonishing. Now, a lot of people might say, would Aaron Rodgers play football if he wasn't earning $50 million a year? And to my answer to that would be, well, the people who really love football love it because they're great at it, and they make miracles with their bodies, and they are given a tremendous amount of love and adulation and fame from the culture.
They are going to bring pressure again. Rodgers is going to roll away, throws it up in the air, says a prayer, and Janis does it.
Oh, stop it!
Oh, please!
What a catch!
That's insane!
Oh, my, that may be one of the great throws ever made. Moving to his left, falling away, and launching a perfect throw.
That's insane.
The fact that our capitalist system converts that fame into millions of dollars is really a byproduct of the attention and adulation that we feed them. And to me, if I were a football player, I think probably, and I spent my life getting good at football and feeling the importance of a team game and the sacrifice for the greater good of the team doing well. And everybody knew me wherever I went and said, hey, you're Aaron Rodgers, that great quarterback, right? Or Steve Allman, that lousy quarterback. I think that would be enough of an incentive for me to at least consider playing professional football, knowing that, okay, I'm not necessarily going to earn billions of dollars, but remember, we're in a Marxist world. Nobody's earning billions of dollars. What I'm getting is the adulation of people respecting the miracles I make with my body when I play football. I think that would be a pretty good incentive for a lot of football players.
Yeah, I think so too. Let's take this one step further and imagine that there is a Marxist version of NFL films, MFL films, which I think would feature a lot of agitprop. What do you think MFL films would look and sound like?
You're right. The NFL films is sort of the propaganda wing of the NFL, and it's big on valorizing the kind of masculine combat and the toughness and emphasizing sort of in a way that good propaganda does just how dramatically thrilling it is. I mean, I wrote against football as a way of trying to examine the moral kind of underside of the sport. But I'm a fan. I'm a hardcore fan in recovery. I have trouble looking away when the replays are on the TV at the gym. I am not tearing myself away saying I mustn't watch this brutal sport. I'm like, okay, how did the Raiders do? So I think that NFL films would probably be an interesting combination. You would have the dramatic music. You would have the tough linebacker making the big hit and the dramatic sort of flow of a particular game. But then you can imagine that at the end of that clip, they would say, you know, this season the NFL has generated $13.75 billion. Let us show you some of what the NFL has done for you. And then you would have a beautiful montage of all the things that $13.75 billion could do for the cities where NFL teams exist. Cities, right, like Green Bay or Cleveland or Baltimore. There's a tremendous amount that kind of money could do to improve schools and create economic opportunity and care for the sick and really comfort the afflicted. And if NFL Films wants to throw in their lot for being a humanitarian organization and publicizing the way in which your fandom of football is helping your community, I am all in on that propaganda film.
Excellent. Thank you. Steve Allman, thank you so much for joining us to talk about the Marxist Football League. And I anticipate, well, you're kind of busy with your writing and stuff, but I think you would make up the perfect commissioner for the MFL.
Well, I will go ahead and accept that as the job that I will have in a few years when our mutual dream of a truly Marxist NFL comes true. It's not that much of a reach. It's not like we're taking on the central entrenched powers in the culture. You know, a couple of guys like us, we can get this done. We can do it.
Absolutely. I look forward to working with you on it.
All right, great.
Thank you, Steve. Steve Almond is the author of Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. Comrades, you will find out more at WPR.org/beta. After hearing Steve talk about the idea of a Marxist football league, it got us thinking about how we'd all be on the same playing field as football players. Maybe, just maybe, we'd close our show with credits just like they do on primetime football games. Now let's meet today's starting lineup.
Steve Gotcher, producer, music and technical director, University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point.
Tyler Ditter, producer, University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh.
Adam Friedrich, executive producer, nay, showrunner, the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee.
Doug Gordon, host, producer, University of British Columbia, go Thunderbirds. Nah, that doesn't have the same ring to it. Oh well, let's do this the old-fashioned way. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Frankie Quinones, Sandra Newman, and Steve Almond. Beta is available on Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Search Beta and Wisconsin Public Radio to subscribe, like, and comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve the Rev Gotcher.
He's a Unitarian Universalist. Those fools are like hippies, but angry.
Additional production by Tyler Ditter.
It's not about me, okay? It's about me helping all of you.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Why does your body still look 19, but your face looks 56, fool?
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
You're 5'5" at best. Now go back to your bush.
Trying to make it real.